Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 26th of March. A topic that probably we've overlooked the last few months and the country has overlooked as well, understanding the conflict in Afghanistan, the first hour of our program today. Professor Nazi Shahrani is with us, a professor of anthropology and professor of Central Asian and Middle Eastern studies at Indiana University. He is a native of Afghanistan and says his personal conviction, formed in the mid-60s as a college student in that country, that anthropology was a discipline relevant to the future development of countries like his homeland, sociocultural anthropology in particular, offering analysis of and remedies for contemporary social problems, grinding poverty, injustice, inequality, socioeconomic and technological underdevelopment. He has done a lot of work in the country, although it had been difficult for anthropologists in 1978 when the country was no longer safe for traditional ethnographic research. But he said that he could not in good conscience abandon research on his homeland and morally, emotionally, and intellectually could not ignore the war. So he's done a great deal of studying of this current conflict and the conflicts that have been raging in Afghanistan for a long, long time, a century, he says, of wars, colonial, anti-colonial, nationalistic, revolutionary, interventionist, and the war on terrorism, which has had devastating results for the country. We'll be welcoming phone calls. We'll start with what's going on in 2008. The picture isn't pretty. And welcome your phone calls, as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Joining us in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee line is 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to send an email, you could do that. That's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org for you to join our conversation. Professor Shahrani, thank you so much for being with us again. A pleasure to have you on the air.
Good morning, Kathleen. It's really a pleasure to be with you again. My voice is a little odd this morning. Forgive me, but I hope you can hear me well.
We're coming through loudly and clearly. You can't hear it in your voice at all. Let's start with what's going on in 2008. I was amazed, and this is so much out of the news, I wonder why. The number of suicide attacks in Afghanistan, 566 incidents for last year. That's a huge number.
Indeed. When you put this in perspective, that during the entire decade of anti-Soviet war in Afghanistan in the 1980s, not a single incident was ever reported. And it did not, in fact, happen until 2002. The beginnings of it was after the intervention, this last intervention by the United States and our allies in Afghanistan. And since then, of course, it has become increasing in astronomical shape and form, if you from the number you've just said. This is unprecedented in the history of the country's struggles against all kinds of foreign invasions and invaders. There's obviously some kind of connection between what is happening in Afghanistan and what has been going on in Iraq. So there is probably some links in the sense that much of the suicide bombing and its effectiveness proved itself in the Iraqi war theater, and that it has been to some extent perhaps taken to Afghanistan. Afghan authorities have always said, perhaps incorrectly, that these suicide bombers are not Afghans, they're all outsiders. These are either Arabs or Pakistanis and so on, or Chechens or Uzbeks or, you know, somebody other than the locals. That obviously has proven not to be the case. There certainly are non-Afghan citizens involved in these suicide attacks, but there have been also many Afghans who have joined, and indeed Taliban have, at one point, I think last year in 2007, said that they have 2,000 people lined up to engage in such operations, and there may be more.
We hear about the displacement of a number of people in Iraq. Have a number of people in Afghanistan been displaced as well?
Well, obviously, I mean, in the provinces where there are these six or seven provinces in the south and southwestern parts of the country and eastern part, they have rural population who have left provinces like Helmand, Zabul, parts of Kandahar. A lot of them have gone into the major cities like Kandahar, the city of Kandahar itself, or the provincial capitals of those provinces. Many have also, I think, fled to Quetta in Balochistan, Pakistan, just south of the Afghan border. So yes, there have been displacements, and also people I've seen actually on television reports from Kabul who have gone all the way to Kabul, to the capital city. You know, that capital city is now, Kabul is, sometimes people talk about, 3.5 to 4 million people. It's not a city that was built or had the amenities for more than 500,000. And now you have 3.5 to 4 million people. And where did they come from? A lot of them are obviously returning refugees from Iran and Pakistan, but there are also refugees, internal refugees, who are being displaced from rural areas where the war on terror is going on within Afghanistan, who are taking refuge in safer towns and cities in the country.
Why is it, do you think, Professor Shirani, we are paying virtually no attention to Afghanistan? It's just not in the news at all.
Well, there is this impression, I think, that the government here, and maybe to some extent the media, have created that somehow we have won the war in Afghanistan, whereas the war in Iraq has not been won or has not gone well and so forth, so that there is a lot more attention, although even in Iraq, I think the media is slacking in, mm-hmm. in the last, many months. A part of it is, I think, just the government's ability to somehow create this attitude that things in Afghanistan are going fine and that we shouldn't pay much attention, and not much attention is paid. Indeed, there is a lot of waste going on. A lot of things are not going as well as the people of Afghanistan certainly expect it should be going. And I think our own people here in the United States are kept in the dark about what really is going on in Afghanistan. Someday we may wake up to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be, again, too late. We have already spent huge amounts of money in that country, basically fighting war that has produced us nothing, certainly not in the area of security, either here in the U.S., or for us and our soldiers there, or for the people of Afghanistan. It has gotten worse.
And evidently hasn't done much for the economic well-being of the people of Afghanistan. Opium production up to $10 billion a year, 40% going to the Taliban. We had heard a lot about the opium production when this war started, that, well, yeah, that was going to be eliminated, but it's up.
Well, it is, and I think nobody is asking the question as to what might be our own role in both in its production, in its refinement and distribution. Why should? I mean, wherever these wars go, and you remember in the old days when the war in Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos and these places were going on, that area was the triangle, the golden triangle for opiate. And there were military wars going on, I mean, interventions going on there. And before our intervention, during the Soviet era, even before 2011, certainly opium was being produced in smaller quantities. And, some smuggling and mafia sorts of things were going on. But it was nothing like what has become since the intervention. So why shouldn't we not ask the question, is what exactly is the connection? I'm not absolutely certain, and nobody has really, I just reviewed, I should say, a book by a British author, a sociologist who has worked for the UN drug intervention, a gentleman named David MacDonald.
Mm-hmm.
And the book is called Drugs in Afghanistan, and then some additional subtitles. Mm-hmm. One would have thought that a book like that would give us some solid information about some very basic questions about the nature of, drug production, its trafficking, its refinement, and so forth. There is very little in all of that. The question is not even raised as to why should the production of opium multiply
right
over the last 6-7 years by almost threefold.
Oh, my gosh. Threefold
yes,
increase.
Threefold. I mean, they were talking about maybe 2.5 thousand tons or something of that sort. Now it's 10,000 tons of opium being produced in the country.
Well, why is that? You've studied this area. What's going on?
That's what I'm saying, that what is going on is that there is huge demand for it.
Right.
And that people who are involved, and it's not being consumed in Afghanistan, by the way. The farmers basically produce for them, it's a cash crop.
Mm-hmm.
There is very little. This book is supposed to be giving us all kinds of ideas about, you know, the increased drug use in Afghanistan. And the whole picture is really extremely vague. And I'm sure there is some small amount of drug abuse increased in the country, most of it probably because of refugees who got into the habit in Pakistan and Iran, where drug users were far more common, that may be reflected in the statistics inside Afghanistan. But I can assure you, in rural areas, people who grow poppies are not using them. They're not using them as drugs,
mm-hmm.
except maybe for medicinal purposes, or occasionally in small quantities. Much of this is being shipped out of the country
right.
through Central Asia, and through Iran, through Pakistan, into the Western European countries and North America. So who is bringing all of this to these markets that makes it so lucrative for people who make huge amounts? I mean, this is billions of dollars in mm-hmm. here. Those billions of dollars are not falling in the pockets of the Afghan farmers.
Mm-hmm.
They are in the pockets of drug dealers and those who smuggle them across these spaces and bring them here. So why is it that we spend so much money in Afghanistan, presumably in policing that country, or helping through creating these 80-something thousand policemen now and officers and so on and so forth? Are they, in fact, assisting in the dissemination of these drugs rather than controlling them and preventing them?
Mm-hmm.
We're not asking the tough questions as to why.
We're not asking any questions.
My own assumption is that somehow the military and the security forces, maybe international as well as national within Afghanistan, may be involved in all of this.
Hmm.
If so, why not investigate and find out, come to the bottom of it? And you cannot blame all of this to Taliban, that, you know, Taliban are they only operate in 7 provinces of the country.
Didn't we have a plan, or didn't somebody have a plan in place many years ago when we started all of this to move farmers off opium production to something else?
Well, there have been no plans. There were no plans. There are no plans. There is talk of introducing substitute crops. But that has not really resulted to anything. And it's not, you know, farmers are very smart, like any other, people watching market situation. If the price of opium goes up and they calculate, if they put an acre of land under poppies, versus under wheat or rice or potatoes or something else, which one would give them, you know, more
mm-hmm.
possibility of making a living out of?
Mm-hmm.
And if it is going to be poppies, then they would grow poppies. And if it is going to, you know, if the price is not good, growing wheat is better or potatoes, they would do that. I remember very clearly in 2002, the first time I went back to Afghanistan after many years, the area where I grew up actually is a poppy growing area. And, you know, people had some poppy fields growing and so forth in 2002, but they were desperate. Their conditions were just horrible. They were hungry. They had just come out of drought condition in the country and so forth, and they were looking basically forward to a season with some kind of a harvest. And that year, for some reason, our involvement there, the opium prices went sky high. A pound of opium used to be around $25. By 2003, it had jumped to $225.
Oh, my goodness.
$225 for a pound of raw opium. Huh. Now, if you're a peasant farmer, what would you do?
Right.
So by 2003, when I went back, more than half of all the land in the valley were under opium. And the whole village scene had changed. People were coming from all over the country, from eastern, everywhere, bringing goods into the area. And, you know, people made a little bit of money that year. And then by 2004, for some reason, the prices plummeted back down to $50 or $60. It wasn't as lucrative. And people in 2004, 2005 were not growing as much, putting as much of their land under that.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is Professor Nazi Shirani, who grew up in Afghanistan, and we're looking at trying to understand the conflict. We just haven't shed much light on this in a long time. Nobody has. What's going on in the country? It's absolutely astounding statistics about the opium production, aren't they? Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to join us via email, you can do that as well. That address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls for Professor Nazi Shirani, Professor of Anthropology and Central Asian and Middle Eastern Studies at Indiana University, and he's a native of Afghanistan. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, and a couple lines are open for you. We start with Jeremy from Wrightstown. Hi, Jeremy.
Good morning. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
First of all, I'd like to recognize Indiana University and their efforts in language, the robust language training that they have for Central Asian studies.
Hmm.
I just wanted to pose a question because something you said earlier struck me as interesting. You mentioned the role of the security forces, Afghan National Army, police, mm-hmm. Possibly the National Security Director, the NSD there.
Right.
I'm wondering if you have any data on their mean wage annually, and what role that would possibly play, as we know with drugs, you know,
right.
Why would a policeman stop someone from distributing opium if they can make much more by simply being paid to look the other way? I guess that's my main point, and I'll take my answer off.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Jeremy, I think you've raised a very important question. There is no doubt that the police and military folks in Afghanistan and the new forces that have been created are paid a lot more than teachers. But it's still not very much. It's probably, although I don't know for sure, teachers are getting paid around $40 to $60 a month. And there's maybe double that, $80 or $100, $150, maybe $200. But it's still not much. So that, yes, low wages may be one of the reasons why people would indulge in corrupt activities. But the unfortunate thing is also a lot of offices, particularly the more important middle level and higher level security offices as well as political offices are bought and sold. They have price tag in Afghanistan, and people pay them. And if you pay to get appointed in an office, obviously the understanding is that you have to make it up. And so that the corruption is one of the worst maladies of this current government. The level of corruption in the country has absolutely no precedent at the level in which it is right now being practiced in the country at all levels. So that certainly is a very important factor in why drug smuggling and drug trade is getting so powerful within the country.
And thanks for your call. Let's go to Chet next. Hi, Chet.
Hi, Kathleen, and hello to your guest.
Thank you.
I have a couple of comments and a question. Certainly, the issue about poppy production and then, of course, it's transferring to opium. And there is a lot of news actually coming out of Afghanistan through a news source on the web called News Now, Afghanistan. I don't know the exact email address, but I follow it because I have a research. I have an endeavor called Coalition Memorial Way. I track the coalition deaths, and just quickly, between April 1st of 2007 and August 31st of 2007, 131 coalition forces died in Afghanistan, and I honestly don't know how many Afghan National Army forces died. That's one point that, yes, that news is off the radar, although it's out there if you want to find it. Several news features I came across regarding poppy production is one interesting feature was that, in fact, there was a plan put forth by not I don't know whom that to actually allow the production of poppy poppies and for the purpose of its conversion into morphine. And that, in fact, that idea was largely nixed by, and this is a rumor, but it was in several news features, the idea of poppy production in Afghanistan being transferred into the production of morphine was nixed by U.S. pharmaceutical companies and one of the largest producers of poppy plants and morphine, which was the United Kingdom. So I'm wondering if your guest has any thoughts about that or knowledge. Also, I have a question. Simply, does your guest believe that it is in the best interest of Afghanistan that U.S. forces one day entirely leave? And I'll take my comments.
Thanks, Chet. Thank you.
Okay, a series of very interesting questions indeed. The poppy production and plans for changing that, one of the substitute crops, believe it or not, Kathleen, that has been proposed is growing saffron. And they have, in fact, started that, but it's not getting anywhere. It just doesn't compare in terms of, you know, know-how, knowledge that people have of the, how to grow poppies and so forth, and the demand is growing. As long as the demand is there, people will find a way to offer the goods that people want. On the level of, you know, how much opium is needed globally, annually, for pharmaceuticals, the figure that I've seen in the book that I mentioned to you earlier on, Drugs in Afghanistan, apparently the world pharmaceutical companies require about 4,000 tons of opiate a year. So if that's the case, we still have a surplus of 6,000 more tons of opium out there that is not going to be needed or absorbed by the legitimate uses of that product. So that it'd be left to be turned into heroin and other things and hit the streets here in the United States and Europe. So that is the challenge. In some ways, if opium was legalized in Afghanistan, you would probably bring the price down. And if the price comes down, the farmers would not be interested in doing it. There has to be some kind of control mechanism there to adjust basically the supply-demand factor that, you know, this is a capitalist economy we're talking about. And peasants are good capitalists when they have a particular, you know, interest in what they grow. On the issue of the leaving of the United States forces from Afghanistan, this is a very, very, very challenging question. The reason that people welcomed the United States forces in 2001 in Afghanistan was the fact that we helped them get rid of Taliban and Al-Qaeda from Kabul. And we enjoyed tremendous amount of respect and credibility from the people of Afghanistan during 2002-2003. But slowly that got squandered, basically. And what has happened is that Taliban have come back, or the new Taliban, stronger and more threatening. And now, the reason why the people of Afghanistan once again want the United States forces to stay in Afghanistan is not so much because of their respect and all the other wonderful things that initially was there, but because they fear that if the United States forces left, or the coalition forces of the ISAF and the United Nations, NATO, and so forth, that the Taliban will be back in the country. And it's that horrible fear, the fear of Taliban and they coming back to the political scene, that makes virtually every Afghan citizen who is not part of the Taliban resistance or force against the United States, that U.S. forces and international forces should stay on, because without them, the country would be once again overrun by Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And, of course, that would be a horrible development, not just for Afghanistan, certainly a disaster for them, but it will be also for the region and for the entire world, and especially the United States of America. So the problem is not us being in Afghanistan. It's what we do in Afghanistan, and how we conduct ourselves in Afghanistan, and how we spend our money in Afghanistan. Those are the kinds of things that I think we need to ask this administration, and maybe the next administration, we hope, will have a different kind of approach to the problem of our involvement in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. Professor Shirani, what about the growth of the Taliban? This UN report says that it's much more active in more parts of the country. They control large rural areas in the south, though no cities. Is that true?
It is absolutely true. I'm, you know, government of Afghanistan may say otherwise, but U.S. intelligence sources, I mean, we have heard also in the hearings in Congress, our own sources, analysts, and so forth, who have said that a large swath of parts of the country where Taliban have sway, and that is, again, the southwestern parts of the country, eastern part of the country, that they do control districts after districts in rural areas, and that they are present there. And much of that has to do with how our military has conducted itself in those areas. They have relied on aerial bombardments. They have gotten bad information. There's a lot of tribal animosity and bad blood, as it were, historically between some groups and some villagers and so on. So if one sides with the United States or with a particular organization that has the power of bombing an area, they might basically give bad information that the people they don't like, the villagers they don't like, the area they don't like, are part of the Taliban, and, you know, or Taliban are hiding there or some such. And then the military forces go and bomb the hell out of those villages. Mm-hmm. And that's what has happened. And a lot of villagers have become extremely unhappy. Mm-hmm. Also, the military has basically gone into these search and destroy missions, walked into people's compounds, dishonored. You know, there's a lot of honor issues here, mm-hmm. these sort of cultural sensitivities that Afghans complain that army and military forces that are operating in those theaters have not been sensitive enough, and that has angered people. And on the whole, that very little has been really delivered to the people, either in terms of security or economic development, in order for them to be able to stay away from Taliban. So they are saying, well, maybe during the Taliban we had a better deal. Or even if they didn't have a better deal, out of fear, they have to, since the U.S. is not going to be there, Afghan government is not going to be there watching 24 hours over their security in their villages, they go in and come out.
Mm-hmm.
Then they're at the mercy of the Taliban, so that people have to basically give in. And in many instances, I think people simply have said, maybe they're better off with
mm-hmm.
Taliban.
Carl from Madison is next. Hi, Carl.
Hi, Kathleen and Professor. Boy, this is going to be tough because I don't want to go on and on and on, but it seems to me that most Western observers and people that have opinions about what's going on in Afghanistan, who were born and raised in the West, have so many contradictory opinions about what my question basically is, and yet I find that most people who are native to that region sort of agree on the following. And what I want to know, well, let me say what the following is, and I'll ask the question, that the Pakistan SIS has a varied history, and it's changed, and who knows who really controls it right now or in the past. But it seems to be consistently held by people from that area that Pakistan wants to establish some sort of hegemony over Afghanistan, especially in the eastern parts of Afghanistan. And my question is, given that Pakistan didn't exist, what is the what's the raison d'etre for Pakistan wanting to establish some sort of hegemony over the eastern part of Pakistan?
Okay.
Well, your question about the involvement of Pakistani intelligence service, it's called ISI, from the 1980s on has been quite heavy. And I've always said Pakistan doesn't have one government. It's always three parallel governments. In Afghanistan, it seemed to have four of them. And, you know, when you have parallel governments, it's tough to sort things out easily. The Pakistan's three government is, one is basically the military, one is ISI, and the other one is the political parties. Right now, I suppose it's the turn of the political parties. We see what they do. But the military and ISI are parallel powers there that any government politically elected or otherwise have to be content with, and that they are not necessarily, these three parts of the Pakistan government do not necessarily have the same agenda. ISI had an agenda of securing Afghanistan for Pakistan for good, and they put their lot with a particular ethnic group, and that happens to be the Pashtun, which they themselves have a very large population of along the Afghan-Pakistan border. And the reasons are many. You know, that border between Pakistan and Afghanistan was drawn in the 1890s by the British. And British purposefully divided the Pashtun community into two halves, kept the areas that were agriculturally most productive within British India, and then give these sort of barren mountain hills with nothing, where there are also Pashtuns living, so to the Afghan state. And then, you know, that borderline has never been recognized officially by the Afghan rulers, although they conceded at the time, but they have not officially accepted that. So that's part of the dispute when Pakistan was created in the 1947, the division of the two countries, I mean, it's Indian subcontinent into India and Pakistan, that became Pakistan's border. And there have been incidents. So the Pakistanis thought by getting a friendly Afghanistan or by having a sort of a subordinate Afghanistan, they should be able to get rid of that problem of border dispute for good and so forth, which has not happened. Afghans of all ethnic groups are quite nationalistic about these issues, and nationalism is the bane of our lives, I suppose, has been in the 20th century and will continue, at least in that part of the world, well into the 21st century.
And colonialism has been the bane of Afghans' lives in many other places in the world, right?
Of course, yes. They are the ones who drew.
Right.
They introduced the idea of nationalism and nation-state, which has been, and particularly in these multi-ethnic societies, has been a terrible development rather than an improvement. So that Pakistanis thought, again, if they controlled Afghanistan, they might have advantages against India. You know, there are people in Pakistan who actually think in terms of what they call the nuclear depth, security depth or some such. They think if there was a nuclear war between Pakistan and India, they could perhaps hide in the mountains of Afghanistan, which is ludicrous.
Hmm.
But you know, there are a lot of other issues that seem to be driving Pakistanis to wish to have some kind of control over the government in Kabul that would be friendly to them and so on. And that obviously hasn't happened and may not happen.
Thanks. Thanks, Carl, for your call. Did you have a peaceful childhood growing up in Afghanistan, Professor Shirani, or not?
Oh, there was a peace, a sort of a peace in prison. You know, prisons are very peaceful places. If you, it wasn't that bad, I must say. There was no war, at least.
Mm-hmm.
The government was not necessarily, you know, democratic by any stretch of the imagination. But at least during the my period, anyway, 1940s on, I left the country around 1967, coming to the United States to study. And by the time I finished, the war began there.
Mm-hmm.
Those 50s, 60s, you know, were good times in Afghanistan. There was no particular active violence against the government, but certainly government was violent, but the violence was more controlled.
Mm-hmm.
They basically hit people who tried to do something against them rather than sort of, you know, violence at large. They certainly, it was a corrupt system. People were oppressed in varieties of different ways, but it wasn't anything like what the country has experienced since the Soviet invasion in 1979.
More phone calls in a moment. Our guest, as we talk about understanding the conflict in Afghanistan and paying attention to what's going on in Afghanistan, Professor Nazi Shirani, professor of anthropology, also a professor of Central Asian and Middle Eastern Studies at Indiana University. He is a native of Afghanistan, and he's also had positions at the Smithsonian Institute, Stanford University, and Harvard University. As he said, grew up in Afghanistan and came to this country in 1967 for his studies. Call us. We have a couple lines open, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. If you'd like to send an email, do that at talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, Michael Connery will be joining us. And Michael is the author of Youth, In Youth to Power. And the book looks at the potential impact of the millennial generation in politics. He looks at the history of youth political movements and the challenge that progressives face in attracting today's rising generation of young voters. We go to more phone calls now at 800-486-8655 for Professor Nazif Shirani. And let's go to Marnie from Oconomowoc. Hi, Marnie.
Good morning. I just started listening, but I find this very interesting. And I have a question because I just read 1,000 Splendid Sons, and in the book it alluded a lot to the fact that times were much better for women in particular when the communists were in control. And I found that really interesting, and I wonder if he has any comment on that.
Certainly. I think the lot of urban women, particularly in Kabul, was improving considerably in the 1960s and 70s. They were having access to education, particularly in the fields of medicine and also teaching profession and so forth, that they were becoming part of the workforce within the government offices and so on. And then one of the things that the communists did in communism, both the Bolshevik Revolution within Russia, former Soviet Union, and then when they came to the Central Asian Republics, they basically focused on the issue of women having been oppressed by these traditional Muslim societies and that they were going to liberate them. And in the name of that liberation, they basically opened up additional space for women in these societies, particularly in Afghanistan, in Central Asia. They had done that in the 19. It went through, of course, a very violent periods of reaction against these developments, against Soviet authorities. But eventually, they were crushed, and that woman did get in Central Asia high levels of education, apart from with men, although their burdens doubled, that now they were having to do both the homework as well as work in the fields and in the offices and factories and so forth. I'm not sure in the long run women enjoyed all that much, or gained a great deal, but certainly on the surface it appeared that they were doing better. In Afghanistan, the same thing was attempted during the Soviet occupation period, the communist era, 1980s, that in the urban area, particularly in Kabul, women were more present in the offices and schools and so forth. Part of that had to do with the fact that their male members, particularly young people, were drawn into fighting. They were forced to go out to the military force and go out and fight against the Mujahideen and the resistance, so that women were left to do. And they had to rely, they had to have some force. And I think women perhaps benefited from that. But they also offered certain kinds of liberties that in traditional societies there was resistance against. So depending on how you look at that, again, if you look from the traditional Afghan perspective, of course, that aspects of that was not appreciated. In fact, people resisted or fought against, but there were certain things which definitely benefited women. And it may not have been so much intended, wholly intended. It was rather the consequences of the environment in which women found themselves, with most of the males on both sides being out there in the battlefield killing each other or killing the Soviet army, and women were left in the urban areas to then go to school, universities, and do the work in the offices and so on, which certainly was advantageous to them. You remember, it's not that different from what happened here in the United States in World War I and World War II.
Right.
That women gained a lot during those episodes of war when men had to leave for battle and they were left here to carry the country through.
Thanks, Marnie, so much for your call. Arvin is next from Chicago. Hi, Arvin.
Oh, hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
I'm good. I was actually listening to the wonderful discussion going on. I'm a native of India. I'm a U.S. citizen, but I've been here for like almost 20 years now. But I'm from a place which is Kashmir in the north of India. And since we're talking about one of the countries like Pakistan being in the middle of Afghanistan with the professor and also India on the other side, I have gone through a process where there was back in the 1990s when there was ethnic cleansing going on in Kashmir, and nobody even talks about that part. And I know what's happening in Afghanistan is obviously U.S. is involved right now. A lot of things are going on, but I'm just trying to understand, the professor's view of how Pakistan should be handled, by itself or by U.S., so that, we have more peace in that region, because everything has a cascading effect. As something happens in Pakistan, it has a cascading effect on Afghanistan and India, and particularly Kashmir. And I've left Kashmir, so many years now, because of the ethnic cleansing, and how we should handle this thing, because it's like a hot spot right now.
All right, what should we be doing, Professor Shirani?
Well, Kashmir is a very, very unfortunate and a tragic situation that has gone on for more than half a century now, or half a century to a little more than half a century, yes, 60 years almost. The problem is, this is again the consequence or legacies of the colonial partition of India and the dispute that they left behind between these borders, between the two new states of India and Pakistan, has been going on with and left unresolved. But much of this really, honestly, to be truthful with you, has to do with this ideology of nationalism and nationalization of states that Europeans introduced in the world, and now in the last 50 years they themselves are pulling out of that. The very countries in Europe that they fought for 150 years of bloody wars to create the borders of France and Belgium and Germany and Scandinavian countries and so forth, now in the last 50 years those things have been ignored and disregarded to create European Union. Such a wonderful idea, to get a united Europe without these borders or not paying much attention to that. And yet, the borders they drew in the rest of the world, people are still willing to fight and die for those lines that they drew over. So we need to question the value and validity of this nationalist idea that people should necessarily have their own little states, mini-states or whatever, with their own flag and with their own this. I mean, that's emotionally powerful and important. So the issue is not so much we need to get rid of these states as they are created on the map, but how can we introduce new rules of governance in these areas where people could, in fact, feel good about who they are and how they should be governing themselves, and be at the same time part of larger political entities that could help them. Mm-hmm. And the only way that I could suggest is to adopt the very basic principle of community self-governance in all of these states. In other words, devolve power, allow communities, just like here in the United States, how have you been able to govern this great country with 50 states, extremely diverse population, diverse interests, and so forth? The only thing that really what the democracy in the United States means is living by the principle of community self-governance. You elect all of your political offices, and then the professional people are recruited by committees on the basis of merit, and nobody pays attention. You depoliticize cultural identities and so forth. These are not the principles that are being applied in much of the rest of the world. India has done very well in the parts outside of Kashmir where they have, in fact, more successfully adopted this policy of community self-governance. And they have achieved. Even Pakistan, at some level, I think, has managed to survive as long as it has because of adopting this particular principle. And if they allowed Kashmiris to run their own affairs, have their own local autonomy within one or the other of these countries, again, on fair and democratic manner, and that's what democracy means, community self-governance with some kind of central government, federal government that makes laws, that not implement those laws, allows the local communities to implement them themselves, and then the central government, the federal government, whatever you want to call it, will monitor and be the sort of watchdog so that people enforce those laws. I think the only way would be to give the Kashmiris the autonomy, the right to determine not only their future, but also be able to govern their own communities mm-hmm. by themselves. And then we would be rid of all of this, and then you can create larger political entities like European Community without, you know, and gradually get rid of the significance of these borders that someone else drew for them.
Thanks so much, Irvin, for the call. Let's try to get to a couple more calls if we can. Kyle from Black River Falls, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to add a couple comments. I served in Afghanistan in 2004 and 2005. Mm. And was with an engineer company, and a lot of our work dealt with building and clearing of roadways. And the one thing I noticed was that it's so hard to understand unless you've actually been there and seen it, how absolutely rugged and inaccessible most areas, or a lot of areas in Afghanistan are. And I think the comment was made earlier as far as the U.S. forces staying to the larger cities, and a lot of that, I think, has to do with the fact that it is so difficult to get to some of these outlying areas and to supply units in those areas. And I just won't take my comments off the air.
All right. Thanks so much for the call.
No, in fact, the United States forces, some of them are in the rural area, I mean, and in the cities, but actually they have created outposts in rather remote areas, and they transport goods and people and so forth by helicopters. They've created these helicopter pads in you know, mountainous areas where they need to be, and they are there. It's not that certainly the terrain is tough in Afghanistan and most parts of it, and roads don't exist, but it's actually, in terms of roads, the country is far better off today than it was in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm. One more phone call. Bob from Wauwatosa, and we're getting short on time. Hi.
Thank you, Kathleen, for taking on a very important topic. This is essential, and I thank you, Professor, for addressing underlying causes and motivations, like when you talked about the drug issue, where it's not so much the supply, but it's really the demand, and those problems point mm-hmm. back to us in the West, and we very seldom look at our own self as being the cause of this. My question goes back to the very first question that was ever asked on 9/11, and that is, why do these people hate us? And basically, if Islam condemns killing innocents like women and children, how are these suicide bombers convinced to do this kind of thing?
Okay, we have less than a minute, Professor Shirani.
Right. I don't think they hate us. I think they hate the policies that has been carried out by our governments in our name for a very, very long time. And I don't think the motivation is Islam. by any stretch of the imagination. The motivation is extremely political, fundamentally political. Terrorism is a political phenomena. It's not a religious phenomena. People may camouflage it, may justify it, may rationalize it, whatever they do, but it's at the core, it is a political problem, and we have not approached this politically and looked at the political causes. And I think this administration and to some extent the media have purposefully made religion an issue. And when you focus on that, you will never come up with a reasonable solution. There is, because it's just simply not a religious problem.
And on that note, we must say goodbye. Professor Shirani, always a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kathleen, for having me. I appreciate it very much.
Professor Nazi Shirani, our guest this hour, professor of anthropology and also a professor of Central Asian and Middle Eastern Studies at Indiana University in Bloomington. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this program, and thanks to Rhonda as well for on-air production here in Milwaukee. Thanks for all of your calls, everybody. Sorry we couldn't get to all of you, but try again. And we'll try and get that author on the poppy trade from England. That would be an interesting show, right? News ahead will return on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.